Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to By the Lyric. My name is Lisa. I hope everyone had a nice break. This is our first show back after being off for a few weeks after exams. So I hope everyone's ready for a new semester with new songs and new meanings. All right, so today we are going to be looking at London Calling by The Clash. So we have a little bit of a throwback. Musically, this song is far removed from The Clash's earlier style of frenzied punk rock of the 1-4-5-1 chord progressions, as best exemplified on songs like Career Opportunities and I'm So Bored with the USA. This song is in a minor key, which is something rare for The Clash, and the inherent dirge-like apocalyptic feel is intensified by Topper Hedden's martial drumming without backbeat. In synchrony with staccato guitar chords, Paul Simonon's haunting and pulsating bass line, the group's deliberate mid-tempo pace, and Strummer's icy lyrics and baleful delivery. Strummer's howls during the instrumental break further fuel the atmosphere of paranoia. So London Calling was The Clash's first single from their third album, and it was released December 7th, 1979. Joe Strummer explained to Melody Maker in 1988, "I read about 10 news reports in one day calling down a variety of plagues on us. The initial inspiration came in a conversation he had with his then-fiancée, Gabby Salter, in a taxi ride home to their apartment in World's End. There was a lot of Cold War nonsense going on, and we knew that London was susceptible to flooding, so she told me to write something about that." He said, "We felt that we were struggling, about to slip down a slope or something, grasping with our fingernails, and there was no one there to help us." The lyrics also reflect the desperation of the band's situation in 1979 when they were struggling with high debt, lack of management, and arguing with their record label over whether London Calling album should be a single or a double album. For the single, the band recorded their fifth music video on the Battersea Pier. So here is our first listen to London Calling. So that was our first listen of London Calling, whose lyrics we're going to be looking at and kind of deciphering today. So let's start with the first verse. "London calling to the faraway towns, now war is declared and battle come down." This is London Calling, was used by the BBC World Service Station to identify themselves in broadcasting to occupied countries during World War II. The BBC program London Calling remained in existence until 1993. In this case, they're announcing the start of another war, which is probably the Cold War. As the song was released in 1979, the Cold War was from 1979 to 1985. And this refers to the face of a deterioration in relations between the Soviet Union and the West, arising from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979. With the election of British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in 1979 and U.S. President Ronald Reagan in 1980, a corresponding change in Western foreign policy approach toward the Soviet Union was marked with the abandonment of détente in favor of the Reagan Doctrine policy of rollback, with the stated goal of dissolving Soviet influence in Soviet bloc countries. During this time, the threat of nuclear war had reached new heights, not seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis. The following words go, "London calling to the underworld, come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls." While there is no exact definition or meaning to these words, I think that they are referring to the band's perception of the government, military, and probably society in general becoming more evil. They are turning towards the underworld and calling out all of the demons and devils out of hell and onto Earth, or out of their cupboards. This may be inspired by the doom felt by Strummer upon reading those 10 articles about the demise of his country. So welcome back to By the Lyric. Again, my name is Lisa, and today we are looking at London Calling by The Clash. So we already know that London Calling is what the BBC World Service Station used to contact occupied countries during World War II. So now we're in the second half of the second verse, and the words go, London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. So these lyrics reflect the desperate situation of the band in 1979. Again, The Clash was struggling with high debt, no management, and arguing with their record label whether London Calling album should be a single or a double album. The words, now don't look at us, also reflects the concern of the band over its situation after the punk rock boom in England in 1977 had ended. The Clash had been one of the bands at the forefront of the punk movement, rivaled only by the Sex Pistols. Here, they tell their listeners that they don't have any solution to the demise of punk. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. Punk groups despised much of the pop music of the 1960s, but even more, their cruel and bitter criticism was directed at the progressive rock of the late 60s and early 70s. The Beatles, with their massive pop appeal and their later move towards progressive music with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and subsequent albums, were emblematic of much of what punks hated. Beatlemania was a term that originated during the 1960s to describe the intense fan frenzy surrounding the Beatles. The Beatles had broken up in 1970, so Beatlemania, one of the things most associated with 1960s England, had indisputably bitten the dust by 1979, which means to fail or come to an end. Just to put things into a little perspective as to how intense this was, Beatlemania is described as the intense fan frenzy directed towards the English rock band The Beatles in the 1960s. Their popularity started growing in the UK in late 63. By the next year, their worldwide tours were characterized by intense levels of hysteria and high-pitched screaming by female fans, both at concerts and during the band's travels. In February of 1964, the Beatles arrived in the U.S., and their televised performances on The Ed Sullivan Show were viewed by approximately 73 million people. In addition to establishing the Beatles' international stature, the arrival changed attitudes to popular music in the U.S., whose own Memphis-driven musical evolution had made it a global trendsetter. From 1964 to 1970, the Beatles had the top-selling U.S. single one out of every 6 weeks. So for 6 years, the Beatles had the top-selling U.S. single one out of every 6 weeks, and the top-selling U.S. album one out of every 3 weeks. In 1966, the frenzy became so much that they stopped touring and became a studio-only band. The use of the word mania to describe fandom predates the Beatles by more than 100 years. It has continued to describe the popularity of musical acts, as well as popularity of public figures and trends outside the music industry. Just like the Beatles inspired a Beatlemania with troves of hysterical fans, many British bands tried to imitate the Fab Four and created a homogenous musical scene that annoyed Mick Jones. The line about phony Beatlemania biting the dust was aimed at all the touristy sound-alike rock bands in London in the late 70s. We were fans of the Beatles, the Who, and the Kinks, but we wanted to remake all of that. We wanted London Calling to reclaim the raw, natural culture. We looked back to earlier rock music with great pleasure, but many of the issues people were facing were new and frightening. Our message was more urgent, that things were going to pieces. The line can also be interpreted as a dig on both the fans that rode the punk rock boom as if it was a craze, and another instance of British music being watered down. The musical, Beatlemania, was described as not the Beatles, but an incredible simulation. It was a Broadway musical focused on the music of the Beatles as it related to the events and changing attitude of the tumultuous 1960s. A rockumentary. Again, it was advertised as not the Beatles, but an incredible simulation. And it ran from 1977 to 1979 for a total of 1,006 performances. Welcome back to By the Lyric. So for those of you that are just joining us, just a reminder that today we are looking at London Calling by The Clash. And we've gone through the first verse, so now we are on verse two. London Calling, see we ain't got no swing. The 1960s are often referred to as the swinging 60s because that decade saw the destruction or reduction of many of the social norms associated with Victorian morality. Swinging is slang for being lively, exciting, fashionable, and sexually promiscuous. In 1965, Time magazine christened London the Swinging City. Wikipedia describes the Swinging Cities as a youth-driven cultural revolution that took place in the United Kingdom during the mid to late 1960s, emphasizing modernity and fun-loving hedonism, with Swinging London at its center. It saw a flourishing in art, music, and fashion, and was symbolized by the city's pop and fashion exports. Among its key elements were the Beatles as leaders of the British invasion of musical acts, Mary Quant's miniskirt, popular fashion models such as Twiggy and Jean Shrimpton, the mod subculture, the iconic status of popular shopping areas such as London King's Road, Kensington, and Carnaby Street, the political activism of the anti-nuclear movement, and sexual liberation. Music was a big part of the scene, with the London Sound including The Who, The Kinks, The Small Faces, and The Rolling Stones, bands that were the mainstay of pirate radio stations like Radio Caroline and Swinging Radio England. Swinging London also reached British cinema, which, according to the British Film Institute, saw a surge in formal experimentation, freedom of expression, color, and comedy. During this period, creative types of all kinds gravitated to the capital, from artists and writers to magazine publishers, photographers, advertisers, filmmakers, and product designers. During the 1960s, London underwent a metamorphosis from a gloomy, grimy post-war capital into a bright, shining epicenter of style. The phenomenon was caused by the large number of young people in the city due to the baby boom of the 1950s and the post-war economic boom. Following the abolition of the National Service for Men in 1960, these young people enjoyed greater freedom and fewer responsibilities than their parents' generation and fanned changes to social and sexual politics. Despite shaping the popular consciousness of Britain in the 1960s, however, Swinging London was a West End-centered phenomenon that only happened among young, middle-class people and was considered simply a diversion by some of them. The swinging scene also served as a consumerist counterpart to the countercultural British underground of the same period. Simon Rycroft writes, "Whilst it is important to acknowledge the exclusivity and the dissenting voices, it does not lessen the importance of Swinging London as a powerful moment of image, making with very real material effect." Then the lyrics go on to say, "Except for the ring of that truncheon thing. So London calling, see we ain't got no swing, except for the ring of that truncheon thing." Truncheon is one of the numerous names for a police baton. Thus, Strummer is saying that by the late 70s, the only swinging in the swinging city was coming from the batons of policemen brutalizing the populace. In 1970s, London, and England in general, was plagued by numerous riots, most of which involved political extremists. The most explosive of these was the so-called Battle of Lewisham, which occurred in 1977, 2 years prior to the release of London Calling. The Clash also criticized the police in their song, "I Fought the Law." The Battle of Lewisham took place on the 13th of August in 1977, when 500 members of the far-right National Front attempted to march from New Cross to Lewisham in southeast London, and various counter-demonstrations by approximately 4,000 people led to violent clashes between the two groups and between the anti-New Front demonstrators and police. 5,000 police officers were present and 56 officers were injured, 11 of whom were hospitalized. 214 people were arrested. Later disturbances in Lewisham town center saw the first use of police riot shields on the UK mainland. Welcome back to By the Lyrics. So for those of you that are just joining us, we are looking at London Calling by The Clash, and we have gotten to the chorus at this point. So the chorus goes, "The ice age is coming, the sun is zooming in." During the 1970s, largely unsupported theories about global cooling received widespread media attention. The theory posited that the slight downward trend of mean temperatures from the 1940s to the early 1970s was a sign of the start of a global freeze, which would culminate in massive glaciation, a sort of second ice age. This phenomenon was ultimately more about media hysteria than actual scientific study. At the same time, in the scientific community, people were becoming more deeply concerned by the threat of global warming, which is real. I think this is about the idea of a nuclear winter, wrote a user on Genius, after an atomic war disaster. Nuclear winter is the severe and prolonged global climactic cooling effect hypothesized to occur after widespread firestorms following a nuclear war. The hypothesis is based on the fact that such fires can inject soot into the stratosphere, where it can block some direct sunlight from reaching the surface of the Earth. It is speculated that the resulting cooling would lead to widespread crop failure and famine. When developing computer models of nuclear winter scenarios, researchers used the conventional bombing of Hamburg and the Hiroshima firestorm in World War II as example cases where soot might have been injected into the stratosphere alongside modern observation of natural large-area wildfire firestorms. The following lyrics go, "Meltdown expected, the wheat is growing thin," likely referring to the economic meltdown of much of the Western world during the 1970s. The post-war economic boom of the late 1940s continued until the late 1960s, when long-festering economic problems came to a head. The recession of the 1970s was particularly painful in that it produced stagflation, where high unemployment and high inflation existed simultaneously. These economic hardships played an integral role in the formation of punk's no-future nihilistic message. The recession also lasted from 1973 to 1975 in the United Kingdom. The GDP declined by 3.9% or 3.37%, depending on what source you're looking at. It took 14 quarters or 3.5 years for the UK's GDP to recover to that of the start of the recession. The oil crisis was largely to blame for the downturn in the United Kingdom, just as it was for the similar crisis in the States, although the real crisis came in the form of the three-day week, which was a result of fears of power shortages as a miners' strike was announced in December 1973. The three-day week was a stage of emergency imposed by Conservative Prime Minister Edward Heath, which came into force on the 1st of January 1974, meaning that commercial users of electricities were limited to 3 specific consecutive days of consumption of electricity and forbidden to work longer hours of those days, although services deemed essential were exempted from these regulations. Electricity blackouts across the country were widespread. There was also double-digit inflation during this period, which peaked at more than 20%. The trade deficit was massive and the national debt was rising sharply. Economic growth was reestablished in 1975 and the recession's end was declared, but Britain's economy remained shaky. Inflation remained high, strikes continued to cripple manufacturing and public services, unemployment continued to rise above the 1 million mark, and just after the resignation of Harold Wilson as Prime Minister in March of 1976, his successor James Callaghan was forced to call on the International Monetary Fund for a multi-billion pound bailout in an attempt to bolster Britain's flagging economy. After a number of years with abnormal weather, also in the early 1970s, wheat crops in much of the world failed. This led to a shortage of wheat on the global market and a dramatic increase in the price of food. Wheat in the United States fared far better than the rest of the world, but this was of little consolation to Great Britain, which was running a massive trade imbalance by the 1970s. In 1972 to 1973, poor grain harvests led to world grain shortages, and some prophets of doom were predicting world starvation, resulting in price increases of about 50%. All right, welcome back to By the Lyrics. So for those of you that are just joining us, we are looking at The Clash's London Calling. So we've gone through the first two verses and the first half of the chorus, so now we are continuing with the second half of the chorus. So the words go, "Engines stop running, but I have no fear. The infamous energy crisis of the 1970s began in 1973 when OPEC, Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, declared an oil embargo in protest of American support for Israel in the Yom Kippur War. In Britain, it coincided with a coal miner strike, furthering the crisis. Things became so bad that Edward Heath's government was forced to shorten the work week to 3 days and restrict electrical usage in 1974, as we mentioned before. Edward Heath's offer of a 13% pay rise to the miners was rejected, and he then responded by calling a snap election on the 28th of February, 1974, in what he saw as an opportunity for the electorate to show the miners that the government, and not the miners or the unions, were responsible for running the country. Most opinion polls suggested that the Tories would be re-elected with a majority, but when the election results came through on the morning of March 1, 1974, no party had an overall majority. The gap between Ted Heath's Tory government and the Labour opposition led by Harold Wilson, who had been Prime Minister for nearly 6 years until his surprise defeat by Heath's Tories in the 1970 election, was so narrow that the Tories received the most votes, but Labour won significantly more seats. The embargo ended in 1974, but was followed by a panic in 1979, the year that London Calling was recorded, when oil output decreased slightly due to the Iranian Revolution. In 1979, or second oil crisis or oil shock, occurred in the world due to decreased oil output in the wake of the Iranian Revolution. Despite the fact that global oil supply decreased only by approximately 4%, widespread panic resulted, driving the price far higher. The price of crude oil more than doubled to almost $40 per barrel over the next 12 months, and long lines once again appeared at gas stations, as they had in the 1973 oil crisis. In 1980, following the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq War, oil production in Iran nearly stopped, and Iraq's oil production was severely cut as well. Economic recessions were triggered in the United States and other countries. Oil prices did not subside to pre-crisis levels until the mid-1980s. After 1980, oil prices began a 20-year decline, except for a brief rebound during the Gulf War, eventually reaching a 60% fall-off during the 1990s. As with the 1973 crisis, global politics and power balance were impacted. Oil exporters such as Mexico, Nigeria, and Venezuela expanded production. The Soviet Union became the top world producer. North Sea and Alaskan oil flooded the market. It seemed that the United States of America and Norway had much more oil reserves than forecasted in the 1970s, and OPEC lost influence. The next line of the song is, "'Cause London is drowning and I live by the river." This comes from the concern that if the River Thames flooded, most of central London would drown, something that led the construction of the Thames Barrier. In 1928, Thames flood was a disastrous flood of the River Thames that affected much of Riverside London on 7th of January 1928, as well as places further down the river. 14 people died and thousands were made homeless when floodwaters poured over the top of the Thames embankment and part of the Chelsea embankment collapsed. It was the last major flood to affect central London and, along with the disastrous North Sea flood of 1953, helped lead to the implementation of new flood control measures that culminated in the construction of the Thames Barrier in the 1970s. So the fear of flooding was real because Strummer actually did live in an apartment right by the river. During Christmas of 1927, a heavy snow fell in the Cotswolds in central England, where the Thames has its source. So just kind of a background as to why it flooded in the first place. A sudden thaw occurred over the New Year's Eve of 1928, followed by unusually heavy rain, doubling the volume of water coming down the river. The sudden rise in water level coincided with a high spring tide and a storm surge caused by a major extratropical cyclone in the North Sea. The storm surge raised the water levels in the Thames estuary, measured at Southend to 1.5 meters or 4 feet above normal. The funneling of water further up the river caused the level to rise even higher. The situation was worsened by capital dredging, which had been carried out between 1909 and 1928, deepening the river channel by about 2 meters to allow access for deeper draughted vessels to the Port of London. This had the side effect of making it easier for seawater to flow up the Thames on a high tide, increasing the flow on a mean tide by about 4% and raising the tidal range by about 0.7 meters. This produced the highest water levels ever recorded in the Thames in London. The flood peaked at about 1:30 a.m. on the 7th of January when a level of 5.55 meters above the datum line was recorded, nearly a foot higher than the previous record. Extensive flooding resulted as the river overflowed the embankments from the City of London and Southwark up to Putney and Hammersmith. Serious flooding was also reported in Greenwich, Woolwich, and other locations further downriver, causing major property damage. Furthermore, the lyric is also a metaphor for London's economic struggles as class inequalities. If the river was represented as the lowest part of the totem pole in London's class system, and Strummer lives by the river, then he'd be the first to drown. This is some gallows humor from Strummer. Throughout the chorus, he mentions all the troubles facing the world, but he won't have to deal with all of that because he'll be dead by then anyways. It should be noted that at the time he wrote the song, he literally did live by the river in an apartment right next to the River Thames. The next verse goes, "London calling to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone." Punk was still huge in 1979, but it was altogether different beast than it had been a few years earlier. Many of the original punk bands had split up, and The Clash were one of the few successful bands left, if you could ever consider their later music to be punk. The general feel was that by 1978, real punk had died as a movement. With the involvement of the recording industry, punk was becoming very commercial, and many imitators were on the rise. Strummer notes this with a line dedicated to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. The larger milieu of the 1970s, its superficiality and lack of substance gets a line as well. "London calling to the zombies of death, quit holding out and draw another breath," are the next lines of the song. This is another allusion to the apocalyptic theme of the song. With all of the impending doom, they may be trying to convince themselves to stop worrying and continue to live, just as the ignorant people they've criticized earlier continue to. "London calling, and I don't want to shout, but when we were talking, I saw you nodding out," are the next lines. Strummer wants people to pay attention to the issues that are facing them without being aggressive and confrontational about it. But despite his best intentions, he feels that level of aggression may be necessary because his audience doesn't care enough to even stay awake with the current means of addressing them. Additionally, nodding out also refers to passing out from drugs, commonly heroin, meaning he is also talking about the apathy caused by casual drug taking. "London calling, see we ain't got no high, except for the one with the yellowy eye." Again, referring to drugs, the sclera, which is the white part of the eye, turns yellow in the setting of jaundice as a result of hepatitis, which is a disease commonly seen in IV drug abuse. Again, a commentary on the carelessness of a nation and the ignorance of real threats facing society. All right, welcome back to By the Lyric. Again, we're looking at "London Calling" by The Clash. So we've gotten to the first two verses, the chorus, the second two verses, and there's one line that changes in the chorus that the next time that they sing it. So instead, in the first chorus, they say, "The ice age is coming, the sun is zooming in, meltdown expected, the wheat is growing thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, because London is drowning and I live by the river." And the second time they sing the chorus, they go, "The ice age is coming, the sun is zooming in, engines stop running, the wheat is growing thin, a nuclear error, but I have no fear, because London is drowning and I live by the river." So the one line that I really want to look at right now is, "A nuclear error, but I have no fear." Lyrically, the song reflects the concern felt by Strummer about world events, with the line about a nuclear error being an allusion to the incident at Three Mile Island, which occurred earlier in 1979. There was a particular nuclear meltdown on March 28, 1979, due to both human and mechanical errors at the facility located in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, where thousands of people were evacuated. The event is credited with bringing about new regulations in the nuclear industry. It was the most significant accident in U.S. commercial nuclear power plant history. The incident was rated a 5 on the 7-point international nuclear event scale, accident with wider consequences. For some perspective, both Chernobyl and Fukushima were ranked at a 7 on the scale, and those two were the only ones ever that were ranked that high. The accident began with failures in the non-nuclear secondary system, followed by a stuck-open, pilot-operated relief valve in the primary system, which allowed large amounts of nuclear reactor coolant to escape. The mechanical failures were compounded by the initial failure of plant operators to recognize the situation as a loss of coolant accident due to inadequate training in human factors, such as human-computer interaction design oversights relating to ambiguous control room indicators in the power plant's user interface. In particular, a hidden indicator light led to an operator manually overriding the automatic emergency cooling system of the reactor because the operator mistakenly believed that there was too much coolant water present in the reactor and causing the steam pressure release. The accident crystallized anti-nuclear safety concerns among activists and the general public and resulted in new regulations for the nuclear industry. It has been cited to have been a catalyst to the decline of a new reactor construction program, a slowdown that was already underway in the 1970s. The partial meltdown resulted in the release of radioactive gases and radioactive iodine in the environment. Anti-nuclear movement activists expressed worries about the regional health effects from the accident. However, epidemiological studies analyzing the rate of cancer in and around the area since the accident determined there was a small statistically non-significant increase in the rate, and thus no causal connection linking the accident with these cancers has been substantiated. Cleanup started in August 1979 and officially ended in December 1993 with a total cleanup cost of about $1 billion. So it took almost 20 years to clean up. So now we're at the last line of this song. It goes, "Now get this, London calling. Yes, I was there too. And you know what they said? Well, some of it was true." A reference that, despite most of the song criticizing media hysteria, exaggeration, and scaremongering of issues, there was usually some grain of truth in most of the stories that genuinely needed addressing. "London calling at the top of the dial, after all this, won't you give me a smile?" This could be referring to, even though there is this feeling of despair, we should still seize the days and enjoy our lives while we have the chance. "I never felt so much alike, alike, alike." Like many of the tracks on London Calling, including The Card Cheat, Revolution Rock, and Jimmy Jazz, the song doesn't end by resolving strongly to the tonic or fading out as most rock and roll songs do. Instead, it breaks down eerily with Joe Strummer's cryptic last words, "I never felt so much alike," echoing over Morse code feedback, the character spelling out SOS. In live versions of the song, Strummer sang a complete version of the final line, which is, "I never felt so much alike singing the blues." This is a direct quote from the first line of Melvin Ensley's Singing the Blues from 1956, which is a popular song recorded by Guy Mitchell in the 50s. It sets up the next track, Brand New Cadillac, which was The Clash's cover of a 1950s rock and roll song. So I have a little clip for you guys to hear just how it sounded live. So anyways, I hope that gave you a little bit of an idea of how The Clash performed that song live. So that's everything that I have for you guys today. I'm going to leave you with London Calling just so you guys can hear it one more time. Again, my name is Lisa. This has been By The Lyric. And coming up after me is Pass The Ox, which is led by our music assistants that help filter any music that comes into the station. So that's always an interesting show if you're looking for new music. Please keep tuning in with me. I am on every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. or sometimes a little later. And I hope to see you guys next week.